Taylor, welcome to KABU in Portland, Oregon.
Great. Hi, Bill. Thank you for having me. I'm happy to be talking to you.
Carrie Taylor teaches history at the Citadel. It's a public military college like West Point and the Naval Academy that are public universities, but the Citadel is a part of the state of South Carolina without a relationship, at least official, to any of the military service in the United States. Carrie Taylor writes and teaches on U.S. and labor history. He edited volumes 4 and 5 of the papers of Martin Luther King Jr. He also coordinates the oral history program at the Citadel, and Charleston has had a radical community over the many years whose living members Carrie has all interviewed and talked to. I recently read an article by Carrie Taylor in Facing South, an internet journal of which he's an editor. It was titled Charleston Workers Renew the Region's Ties to the Highlander Center. It's also about a much larger subject, namely organizing now among low-wage workers in the South, a campaign called Raising Up. Raising up low-wage workers, raising up the minimum wage, and fast food, hospitals, retail, maintenance jobs, so many others, and raising up to build radical communities. So, Carrie Taylor, before we get to the big picture of organizing the South, tell us about that organizing moment, organizing the South, your arrest last December. What happened? What was the outcome? And are you still teaching at the Citadel after your arrest?
I am still teaching at the Citadel after my arrest, and I think that's good for me, and I think it's good for the Citadel as well. I've had an affiliation with the Southern expression of the National Fight for 15 and a union that first emerged, I think, in 2012 in New York City and then spread pretty quickly across the country. We've had a Southern presence of the movement since, I believe, 2013. And I was an early supporter of their efforts here in Charleston, and have been a community supporter of the Fight for 15 for the last 4 years. I'd gotten to know a number of the key worker activists, and so when they came to me and asked that I join them, an act of civil disobedience by shutting down traffic through a central artery in Charleston. Ironically, it was the Septima P. Clark Freeway that we shut down, and Septima Clark was, of course, the very important educator and civil rights activist from Charleston, had a long affiliation with the Southern Christian Leadership Conference and Martin Luther King Jr.
And they named the freeway after her.
That's right. And we shut it down for probably about 30 or 40 minutes, December of 2016, stopping rush hour traffic. And you know, we were actually hoping for a little bit quicker arrest, but the police were hoping we'd leave on our own accord, but eventually came and cleared the street and took us away, but arrested, I think, 7 of us that day, including, you know, myself, a couple of retirees, and 3 or 4 fast food and low-wage workers. But that came it was kind of the culmination of a long day of protests that included, you know, I think we had morning demonstrations, and then the evening demonstration took place in front of a McDonald's. There were probably 150 people on the street in solidarity, chanting and cheering in solidarity with our action, and it was really kind of uplifting. It was powerful to have everyone singing and chanting in unison and cheering, and you know, that kind of enthusiasm carried us protesters through the experience of being put in the police wagon, and then we had probably about a 6 or 8 hour stay in the county jail before we were freed in the early morning hours. So it's my relationships with the workers who'd asked that I join them and other community folks join them at their protests. But think about it in terms of, you know, the neighborhood I live in. I live within walking distance of the Citadel, and it's an economically and racially diverse neighborhood, although it's undergoing pressures from gentrification. But there's a number of low-wage workers in my community, and I think about kind of common sense. Do I want my neighbor to be making $7.25 or $8 an hour, or do I want my neighbors to be making a living wage? And I think it's obvious everybody deserves a living wage.
And having medical care, being able even to take a vacation every now and then.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, these are basic human rights that, of course, a country as wealthy as the United States should be able to provide.
I gather you had to pay a fine or something.
We did. We were guilty, you know, found guilty, and I think we received suspended sentences This was several weeks after the arrest. Our attorney, made a pretty powerful statement to the judge, said that Charleston has a long history of nonviolent civil disobedience and nonviolent protest, and this is in that tradition. And so I think the judge had the option of making us do some additional jail time, but agreed in all of our cases that we should receive suspended sentences.
Let's get back to the impact on Charleston politics and to what extent these moments of protest, what are they leading to, and not just in Charleston, but across the South. I want to ask you the one thing that's really interesting. I read a Charleston paper, I Googled it and found yet the citation, that the Citadel was called by the press and asked, well, what's going to happen to, how are you responding to this arrest of your professor who is in the streets blocking traffic and obviously violating the law? It was interesting what the Citadel said to this reporter. The Citadel responded, at least the spokesperson said, well, he wasn't in uniform and he didn't say he was representing the Citadel. And so that's his personal convictions, and we don't interfere in faculty's personal convictions or academic freedom. And then, of course, he said if he was there representing the college without checking his superior or the provost, things would be different. And reading that, I thought, really, that's really good. At least this bit of military apparatus in the United States, it recognizes the First Amendment and the limitations of what an institution can demand of its workers.
Yeah, I think so. And I don't have any real insight into the administration's response, but I thought they said the right thing. I don't think it was easy. I'm sure they heard some flack from some quarters raising these very questions. What are you going to do about this? This, really appropriate for a Citadel professor. So, I don't think that was easy, the stance they took. And so, I thought that was a real positive indicator because the Citadel has a deep tradition and culture of conservatism. But I think that's an indicator that there's, enough space there for at least a kind of broader conversation around fundamental issues of social justice and democracy. I think that was a good sign, and I was, pleased with the college's response.
And the relations between the military and the state. If the military is just absolutely loyal to whoever runs the state, no matter what orders are given, they carry them out. If it were to kill a lot of demonstrators and to jail everybody, like in Turkey today now or many other countries, the military is loyal. It's very hard for a opposition group to stay alive, much less change the system. And so constitutionalism in the military, it seems to me, is an important value that we want to support, it seems to me.
Absolutely. One of the things that I've valued most in teaching here at the Citadel is that there's a real emphasis on an honor code that the students and everyone else affiliated with the college take very seriously. I think that provides another kind of level protection against the sort of tyranny that you're suggesting by, some kind of collusion between the military or the police force and a regime or a dictator. So,
this is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm talking to Cary Taylor, who teaches at the Citadel. It's a military college. We just talked about his arrest for blocking a street in Charleston, South Carolina, with a lot of other people and several hundred supporters supporting the Fight for 15 campaign, a $15 minimum wage campaign. Cary, that was one moment, that protest that you were involved in. It's happening all over the country, and it's being supported, actually, by the SEIU, which is a controversial union now in the United States. But they've helped provide some of the initial organizing to jumpstart the movement. Apparently, in South Carolina, they've been important, not just in Charleston, but helping movements get together. It's a skeleton crew. But they have been useful. You wrote about that. Tell us about the story of raising up.
Fight for 15 is about 5 years old and began in New York City and has spread, pretty quickly across the country. They've been in the South for 4 years. I was an early supporter of their efforts here in Charleston. And there have been some criticisms, some valid criticisms that the movement is completely reliant on staff, that it's driven by SEIU money, you know, I think, as I'd mentioned in the article that you'd cited, all of that is true, that the role of organizers has been absolutely critical to the success of the movement. But at least from my perspective here in Charleston, the kinds of resources that SEIU and the Fight for 15 have brought to Charleston in terms of, you know, helping nurture a local left, I think they've been invaluable. And the efforts that they've made to nurture and educate workers and to develop them as leaders, I think that's been absolutely tremendous. And I think it's absolutely essential to building a broader movement here in the South. I don't see many other people doing that. So whatever criticisms have been leveled at SEIU, which I think they need to be taken seriously, but at least from my perspective here in Charleston, South Carolina, I think what they've brought has been incredibly valuable, and it can be measured in the kinds of local leaders that they've developed. You know, I'm thinking primarily of fast food and other low-wage workers who've been transformed any number of different levels by their involvement and participation in this movement. See that as good, as positive, and as I said, absolutely essential to this broader project of trying to organize the South.
When I think of organizing the South, the movement that has gotten probably the most press and attention, probably deservedly, as far as I can tell, is the Moral Monday.
The Forward Together Moral Monday movement, and more recently, Reverend Barber's begun building this organization, Repairers of the Breach, which is more or less a national formation, kind of drawing on the resources and experiences of the North Carolina Moral Monday movement.
Mm-hmm. It sounds to me like it also has sort of a black church base, Repairers of the Breach. Is that part of it?
Absolutely. And I think beyond the black church, it's a faith-based approach. And I think this grows out of Reverend Barber's commitment to trying to reclaim moral language for the left. It says, you know, we cannot afford to surrender the language of morality to the Christian right, because they've debased the conversation in their focus on what the theologian Dan McGuire used to call pelvic morality. And Reverend Barber asserts that we need to reclaim moral language for the left and talk about issues of inequality, issues of racism, issues of health care, etc. That this should be every bit as important to people of faith as issues of gays and lesbians or abortion.
Abstinence, education,
whole
group of pelvic morality. But that, this whole...
It's an obsession.
Sexually repressive sort of commitment. Carrie Taylor, give us a sense about the Highlander School and the importance of it and what it does, which has to be replicated almost everywhere. It's a great educational and culture building center. First, tell us about the Poor People's Campaign, and then talk about what Highlander does and its significance.
So the Poor People's Campaign, and it's very much in the planning stages, but again, this is kind of a projection of the North Carolina experience to about 25 other states across the country. And I think the idea is to draw attention to the fundamental issues of economic inequality, but also there'll be an emphasis on health care, racism, on issues of police brutality. But this coincides with the 50-year anniversary of the Poor People's Campaign of 1968, which was Dr. King's final crusade, the effort he was organizing toward when he was assassinated in Memphis in 68. The Poor People's Campaign continued on beyond Dr. King, and it was an effort to join poor people across lines of race and ethnicity in a large-scale effort focused on Washington, D.C., and demanding from our public officials kind of a recommitment to LBJ's Great Society that the administration had moved away from as the country became, and LBJ became, more deeply immersed in Vietnam. So this was an effort to advocate for a recommitment to eradicating poverty and inequality in 1968. So this is 50 years since the Poor People's Movement of 68, and Reverend Barber and the other leaders affiliated with the Poor People's Movement of 2018 are looking to pull together, I think, a real similar kind of coalition to put pressure not only on the national administration, but also there's a recognition that many of the bad policies that have the deepest and most negative impact on poor people are coming out of the state capital. So I think there'll be a real emphasis on putting pressure on state governments to effect change that will, you know, benefit poor, working, and middle-class people.
Carrie, one final issue. This is the old Mole Variety Hour in KBO in Portland. I'm talking to Carrie Taylor, who teaches at the Citadel, who's also an activist in Fight for 15, and the whole larger program of raising up across the South, and then a poor people's campaign that's being planned now. Why only 23 states? Oregon needs a poor people's campaign as much as any state. The inequalities are enormous, of the same kind, as well as the desperation of working people. Carrie, tell us about the Highlander Center, fairly briefly, I'm afraid. The culture building, the music, the political education, you're really building a community culture, a radical culture, and that has to be replicated everywhere. It seems like we're not just building support for one or another piece of legislation. We're really talking about building a whole political movement at the grassroots. Carrie, why don't you talk about that?
Sure. The Highlanders' mission has really been consistent over its 85 years. It was founded in 1932. It's celebrating in September its 85th anniversary. But it's always been about, whether it was working primarily with the labor movement, working with the civil rights movement, or more recently with queer activists and the environmental movement, it's always been about developing people and developing people to be leaders and organizers in their home communities. It's been absolutely essential to the Southern struggle for democracy and justice in so many different ways. You'd mentioned about the importance of culture. I mean, I think that grows out of a recognition that we're not just solely political beings, that it's about much more than that. And so culture has always been an important emphasis within the Highlander program.
And singing, the We Shall Overcome really came out of Highlander, and Guy Carawan, right, is sort of given credit for it when he was at Highlander and semi-popularized the song, and then it just became the anthem of not just the U.S. civil rights movement, but it's sung around the world now.
For sure, and this is a song that's introduced to Highlander through a tobacco worker strike in Charleston in 1945, 1946.
Oh, really?
Some of those workers brought the song to Highlander. It was Miles Horton's first wife, who was then the musical director, who began teaching the song to other groups of workers, and eventually it, with some adaptations, was introduced into the civil rights movement, and then, as you mentioned, it becomes a national freedom anthem. But we see that kind of folk process is dynamic and always changing. And during a recent visit to Highlander with the fast food workers, I had the opportunity to see that process in action as the workers are learning the old songs, learning the old gospel songs and old freedom songs, but then adopting new lyrics based on their own experiences, based on their own struggles, and essentially owning the songs for their own protests. And we did that with We Shall Not Be Moved, and, you know, of course, we sang We Shall Overcome and other freedom songs as part of that program. You know, it's continuing, and it's dynamic. These songs that 20 years ago I may have listened to old recordings from the 30s of those freedom songs or songs from the 60s and thought about them as historical artifacts, but they've been given new life by successive generations of workers, and that's really hopeful. It's powerful to see that, powerful to be a part of it.
Carrie Taylor, thanks so much for talking to us today, and keep up the good work.
Absolutely. I enjoyed talking, Bill.
Right. Me too. So long.